See, we're driving this for a while, but we have reestablished this in control of the state of Oregon.
Good afternoon. We're going to once again open up the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. For the record, today is Thursday, February 10th, 2005. I'm Representative Greg Smith. With us is Monica Brown, our good and competent LFO staff, and Catherine, our committee assistant. Today we're going to be wrapping up Housing and Community Services Department. We're on a whirlwind two-day trip, and we're going to go through the prioritization list and our reduction options. What I think we could do is allocate, based upon those two issues, is an hour for each one. And I think because of the importance of this, we'll allow questions as we go through this. And then based upon time, I may have to tighten it up a little bit midway or towards the end. But I want to make sure everyone has an opportunity to ask the questions that they do. So with that, welcome, Mr. Repine.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. This is kind of a mini-series, the last of a two-day mini-series. there were a couple items that we talked about with you yesterday that we promised or we let you know that we would be bringing to you today. So in front of your desks, chairs, you will find a pile of other information that I'm going to ask Mr. Krieger to identify what they relate to as per the questions that were asked of us yesterday. So, Mr. Krieger?
Thanks, Bob. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Rick Krieger, I'm the Chief Financial Officer for Oregon Housing Community Services. What was passed out was a couple things. First of all, there's a little handout called the Annual Performance Measurement Summary. What this is, Senator Johnson asked about the raw data behind our performance measurements, and that will, for each of the measurements that we have, the eight, it should provide that information for the committee to look at. In addition, you have two other reports. One's a community services block grant report, and this is an annual report that we put out, but it's specific to the ROMA measurements that Gene Arana spoke to yesterday, the national. There's two different handouts. One of them identifies the different national measurements that we have, and then all the specific data is in that community services block grant. So that we wanted to make sure that you had that information.
If I remember correctly, Mr. Chairman, committee members, there were 6 points or elements that are part of that federal criteria for reporting. That report includes those. Any questions on those? Or do we want to proceed?
Proceed, please.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, committee members, this part is talking about our programs and how they are grouped together. So I would ask you to, I'm just going to briefly talk about them. So you have a two-page color, somewhat color, but mostly black and white. We just have a little color in it. And it really, again, if you look at the key color codes up at the programs up in the upper left corner, It follows much in line with our programs that we talked about yesterday and how we group them in group activities as we are department-wise within the agency. These programs, again, because of their commonalities, if you go through them, you'll see how they relate to each other and why they've been grouped in the fashion that they are. And along with that, on this rest of the spreadsheet, it gives you if it's a general fund item, it tells you if it's an other fund item, it tells you if it's a federal fund item, and the total sum. So this is probably a little bit more mining of that information that some of the members were looking for yesterday relative to some of the program's resources that were associated with some of those program dollars that particularly that Ms. Arana was talking about. I'd ask you to turn, just look at the bottom of the second page in the... on your third page, sorry. On the bottom, or again, as you see on the listing of our priorities, we have 53 missions, core missions that we work on at the agency, and this is how they've been defined. Down at the bottom, the question is the process that we use for prioritization, and you'll notice there's a criteria box down there, and I wanted to make sure that you saw and went along with what we use as our criteria. They are aligned in many ways with the governor's priority programs, better health, better prosperity, economic revitalization. So they were weighted in to reflect that. And so along with the four elements of what they represent and their weighting, it does give you a brief definition of of why that criteria was chosen and what it means regarding to our business practices. So that tells you, that tees up to some degree how we have prioritized the items 1 through 53 on the prior pages. So with that being said, now I'm going to let Mr. Krager, who actually developed most of this information, go through it for you, because he really felt like he didn't have a fair enough time to talk yesterday. So we decided we'd let our chief financial officer carry this one.
Sure, really quick. Representative Richardson.
I've just been looking over the items you've presented to us.
Yes.
So before we get into this, I want to make sure that this is useful to us. And so I see a guide to organizing and reporting national indicators, and as I look through it, it seems to be like these are questions and some examples of generally what the indicators are. I see a 2004 National Performance Indicators sheet, which seems to kind of focus on specific indicators, but there's no data in them. It's merely a form. And then I see our measures here, which I don't think are related to these. Do you have the information on where Oregon stands when compared to the national indicator?
That would be Ms. Gina Rana.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Richardson, the guide goes with that short sheet. Those are the new federal indicators that community action agencies will use from this point forward until the federal government makes a decision to change the indicators. Within the notebook, the CSBG 03 report, that's the blue sheet, notebook with the, right, that has the actual Oregon reports related to those national indicators.
Okay, great, thank you.
You're welcome.
Let me ask a question before you step back. Are the reports that Oregon requires standardized or matched up with the federal reports?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, yes, they are. In fact, in developing the criteria for reporting, we do follow the federal guidelines, but we also have our partners at the table in all of our programs and the reporting requirements, and have gained input from our partners on what additional information they would like to report that would be helpful for them in obtaining private funds and resources. So it's a little bit of both. We tailor our reporting in Oregon to the needs of our partners in the information they provide.
Thank you. I'd share with the committee really quick. Yesterday, this department made mention of its partners, and so I decided to call my folks back home, and I have two different sets of partners because of the way my district's configured, and it was very, very positive. Very positive.
Thank you.
So,
thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Krager will be coming back in.
Thank you. Okay, again, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, Rick Krager, Chief Financial Officer for the Department. As Bob had mentioned, we used the four different criteria to go through each of our 53 program activities to try to best we could to prioritize those in accordance to the instruction provided by Legislative Fiscal Office. As a whole, in a lot of these programs, it gets a little difficult because they all sort of work together for one mission. And, you know, our first example is homeless program. Homeless assistance is our number one priority as an agency. That's what we have ranked the highest within the specific criteria that Bob laid out. And you will note that on the first page, priorities numbers 1 through 6 are all related to homeless assistance program. The first in the color-coded blue, the accountability, that's the portion, the core infrastructure that we have in place that Jack talked a little bit about yesterday that we utilize in terms of running our homeless programs. The other five are specifically the emergency housing account, the statewide homeless assistance account, emergency shelter grant program, continuing care, and housing stabilization. Each of these provide a variety of different services. Again, these are all run through our community action agencies and provide services such as case management, homeless shelter, transitional housing, permanent housing, but again, kind of collectively work together. In terms of the funds themselves, one thing I do want to clearly point out to the committee, if you look at the emergency housing account, you note that there's $6.3 million of general fund. That's our largest portion of general fund that is provided to the agency. And then you will also go across and see that the other funds of $6.3, that's a pretty close match.
The emergency housing account is what is part of what's called the Oregon Housing Fund, and the way that works is that when we get the general fund, it is basically spent out of the general fund and put into our Oregon Housing Fund, which is the other fund account where it's allowed to make interest for more homeless assistance. So then when we actually spend the dollars out, it comes out of other funds. So in some ways, that's a duplication. I want to make sure that the committee recognizes that when you look at the emergency housing program, it is essentially a $6.3 million program. So I just wanted to make sure that was clear. the other sources, I know there was questions in terms of the other fund type sources. The majority of all those dollars are specific to our housing finance account that comes that actually we utilize. It's monies off of our bond programs, our housing programs that we generate that actually is utilized within our homeless assistance. So that covers, as I said, essentially priorities. In this case, priorities numbers 1 through 6, but we look at it as a homeless assistance efforts as our number one priority. Mr. Chairman, if you like, I can just keep moving through, or if Please. You want me to stop after each section to answer any question, it's your preference.
I think what I would do is if any committee members have a question, please feel free to just stop and ask. Other than that, let's just move on through.
Okay. Well, I guess just one last mention in terms of the other three areas of our homeless programs. They are federal funded dollars that we receive from Housing and Urban Development as well as the Department of Health and Human Services. So those are our federal dollars. From a match standpoint, our emergency shelter grant, we do utilize our emergency housing account as a matching source for that. Our continuum care has a small portion of local match that's utilized. So from a matching standpoint, it's critical for our emergency housing account is utilized for that as a resource.
Okay, just one quick question then. If we're dealing with only a few items that have general funds, I'd like to look at the one you just described, this the $6.3 million.
Yes, sir.
And yet in column 11 it says 12.6. should that say 6 million too? I mean, I wasn't real clear on
again, that's, I know that's a little confusing. Again, this is a $6.3 million total program. It's sort of a technical element. Again, we have what is called the Oregon Housing Fund. We take the money out of the general fund, so there has to be expenditure out of the general fund. It's recognized on the budget, goes into other funds, and then when we spend it to the community action agencies, it comes out of the other funds, and that's where you get the 6.363.
So the answer is 11 should say 6, not 12.
Well, that's from a program standpoint, yes, it's 6.3.
Thank you.
Moving on to line item number 7 is our Section 8 program. We've ranked that as our number 7 priority. This is essentially federal dollars that we get for subsidized housing. This serves as, I think Gene talked a little bit yesterday, the 30% and below. These are project-based programs. These are not the vouchers. These are project-based. So they're identified approximately, and I'll have to look back tomorrow, but about 300 projects total, I believe, in our portfolio. Of those, 122 are financed by the department. The rest of them are actually financed by HUD or other sources. We, as many of you may recall, being on the committee in the past, are contracting with HUD to actually provide the services for the services for the HUD contract administration. So we provide that, and the subsidies run through it. So it's approximately $101.6 million of subsidy assistance.
As you go through the different loan programs,
mm-hmm.
Can you provide me in the near future an aging of your loan programs? Thank you.
Just to reference the $2.1 million in the other funds, that is essentially the dollars that we receive as a charge for services. That's what we get paid from HUD to do the work of monitoring the Section 8 properties. So it's kind of a fee for services is that's the way it works.
Sure, Chair.
Senator Johnson.
What I'm grappling with is how the local HUD offices, and you're going to have to help me because I don't know what I'm talking about. That'll become clearer as I continue to talk. The local or regional HUD offices, what level of communication is there? And the reason I ask is in this last round of cuts, it seemed to me that those of us who were getting constituent calls or trying to interact with our local offices found varying degrees of capability and understanding locally. What, if anything, does your office do in providing any technical assistance to those local offices or giving them information about new developments at the federal level that they could assist their clients and local policymakers with?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, HUD is, you know, one of those mysterious pieces of federal government. Actually, we're very fortunate in the state of Oregon. We have, a very good HUD Portland office. But as the Section 8 program, which I think you're alluding to,
that's really what I'm saying,
started to unwind with some changes that were put in place without very much notification to any of our housing authority partners, who pretty much manage most of the HUD Section 8 vouchers in your communities. We were working with their organization as a group and individual ones that were faced with some very challenging options. In your case, I think there was a story about an individual who was a quadriplegic who was going to be evicted because they had overutilized their vouchers and they had to get down below a certain number or they were going to be in trouble. We went in there and actually used some other funds that we had that can be used for emergency shelter to you put those money toward those residents who were at risk. And to keep them in that housing until it finally settled out. So we worked with them in a very cooperative financial way just to make sure we didn't have any more headline stories about elderly people or people who were disabled being thrown out on the streets, and made that offer available to all the housing authorities if they had like projects or like conditions that they were faced with. Since that time, many of the organizations have taken very strong positions. Housing Authority of Portland has come out with their white paper now on what they're going to do with Section 8, and they've changed considerably on the amount of rent you're going to get a subsidy, the terms and conditions. It's all subject to review on an annual basis. So they're really having to ratchet down because they know that their resources have been reduced tremendously. As far as the federal government and the HUD disappropriations that are going on, it really is a very steep, slippery slope that we're seeing, that if something doesn't change dramatically here in the near future, we're going to have some real problems, both with Section 8 vouchers and preserving any HUD-funded housing units that were already built under the HUD program. So we've taken it upon ourselves to contact our congressional members, all the congressional members in the state, to let them know the different scenarios that we've been running into and see if we can. The problem with HUD, it's like grabbing Jell-O. You don't know if you got the piece that's going to give you the answer or if the piece that squirts out was the piece that would have given you the answer. So we're trying to use our congressional members to find out where the head of this snake is so we can hold it to the ground a little bit and ask it some questions. So there's an all-out effort working with the Housing Authorities Association and other partners who have a vested interest in Section 8 vouchers and Section 8 preservation units. Are huge in the state of Oregon. It would devastate the state if we lost both elements or any portions of those elements.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Well, I appreciate you stepping into the breach. We had a terrible problem, and I think it was probably instructive for all the state agencies that were dealing with these cuts through the special sessions that we've already endured and potential cuts this time. Adequate and timely notice to benefit beneficiaries or program beneficiaries just strikes me as almost the bedrock against which everything else is built. We did such a bad job communicating with people, and people that were losing programmatic benefits were frightened, and adding uninformed to that was devastating. And I appreciate the assistance that you guys offered, but I see there being a lesson here that we ought to pay attention to when the federal government makes these abrupt changes in course and we don't know how to communicate the answer very well.
It was both difficult for us and it's still been an ongoing problem because, quite frankly, the HUD representatives within the state of Oregon have basically said to us, you've probably gone as far as you can with us and you need to take it up to another level. And with that said, we have gone ahead and made our contacts to the congressional members to try to get somebody's attention on this, and so we're working on it as we speak.
Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One thing just to point out real quick, on, and Monica was really good in terms of giving me some guidance on this, is when we first started our prioritization, I mean, we were at a relatively high level in terms of homeless assistance, rental assistance, and so on. And there are certain program activities that tend to, you know, maybe fall up or go up higher or go down lower, and this is a good example of like rental assistance, which we traditionally see as about our number five priority, but this particular program, because of, you know, within our criteria, it ranks much higher because of, obviously because of unmet need. The low-income population you serve there is critical, and so this is sort of the first example that you'll see that, and I guess that's why I tried to do it in color so that you can see how things may fall out a little bit. Moving on down to priority number eight is our CSB, our Community Services Block Grant. As I already mentioned, the report that will come out to you all before we started here. This is, as if Gina Rana was sitting here, would say that this is a critical piece to the Community Action Agency network. This is, again, the dollars that go out to help the Community Action agencies operate and to be able to run all these anti-poverty programs. So this is a critical element, and again, as you can see from the report, it is sort of the glue, if you will, that brings everything together, and so that's why we definitely get that up there higher in terms of our priority and the need. Again, a $10.1 million federal program. No matching requirement, but there is a small portion of other funds that you can see there. Again, because of the great effort that we go through as an agency, again, our housing finance fund, our bond programs, help subsidize some of that program. And again, that's about the $546,000.
Can you provide us with information on how much of that $10,137,000 goes out in program dollars?
Mr. Chairman, that's, yes, I will definitely get that information.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just someone whispered in my ear and pointed out 90%.
Okay, thank you. Strike the question. Thank you.
Moving on down to priority number 9, and I guess I would just sort of tackle priority 9 through 17. We're moving into our affordable housing development arena. We see this again as a very high priority for the organization. The first number, line item number 10, is our multifamily revenue bond program. This is the first of the bond programs that I will mention. We have our risk share program. These are what we utilize to do bond financing for multifamily complexes throughout Oregon. It is, as you can see, very heavily on the non-limited other fund. What that is primarily bond proceeds, loan repayments, the payment of debt service, loans made. This is our loan activity. So 97.2 is what we're projecting in that particular program. The 2.5 that you see by the funds, again, that's spread from the programs. The bond programs are what generates that, and it's for the cost for running that particular program.
As you show, just really quick, and this will probably be the last question I have on this stuff. You show 6 employees. What's the average size of the portfolios that your loan officers are carrying?
Mr. Chairman, in terms of the average size, I mean, right now, approximately in the multifamily risk sharing program, we have about about $180 million in terms of outstanding loans. This particular unit, they're the ones that are responsible for the underwriting pieces as they come through. They also have an assortment of other types of programs that we'll talk about later down in
so
terms of like pre-development loans.
Once they're
no, sir.
That's passed to a different.
That's correct. Mr. Chairman, after the loans, after we have processed the loans and they're in place, our asset and property managements are the ones responsible for the ongoing property management. And then from a loan servicing standpoint, I think that Mr. Gillespie mentioned Cayuga Law Bank yesterday. That is our bank servicer for taking in the payments and that are passed down to us.
A follow-up on that. I need a little 101 here. So then if a payment is delinquent, it's the responsibility of the bank to send notice out on the delinquent payment?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct, but they also send it at the same time to us so that we're aware of that situation, and then that's communicated back down to our Asset and Property Management Division. They are also aware that if someone has fallen into delinquency, then what are the reasons why that is occurring so that we can get out there.
So Asset Property Management, that's collections or liquidations?
Mr. Chairman, Asset and Property Management, they're the ones that are doing the on-site monitoring to make ensure that we're meeting the compliance of the bonds, that the affordability piece is being met, that the property is being run appropriately, that there's no issues surrounding that. In addition, they have a financial element to that area, that they're reviewing their ongoing financial reports, looking at their surplus property, you know, essentially how the financial parts are being run. That particular position is communicated if there is situations where we run into delinquency. I am happy to say, Mr. Chairman, that we don't have any delinquencies on our multifamily loans at this point. There's been one project that I can think of in the recent last couple of years that we as an agency noted that there was a problem there. We got in there. We put together a team actually out of Mr. Repine's leadership, and we got it fixed.
When we get to round two, we'll be looking at the more into the financial numbers, and the good colleague to the left of me we'll be working on a budget within the Department of Human Services. And could you folks come prepared to talk to us on the partnership or the linkages between some of the money that he uses for clients and how that affects credits that you may have outstanding,
mm-hmm.
Particularly as it relates to assisted living facilities and those type of projects?
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I was just going to just give you want to just kind of paint a larger picture on loans that get either into default or into trouble. If we find out about them before time because they come to us voluntarily, we are an agency who believes that an existing loan is better to find out about that's in trouble and get it repaired quicker than letting it just go off and become a bad asset. And so that's an offering we have with any one of our partners. So when we find out that somebody hasn't made their payment or there's something that seems to be going something peculiar within their operations, our effort is to try to go say, what's going on? How are you? You know, why is it going this way? And what can we do to try to help you?
Does each one of these loan programs have a different loan to value program, or does the department set the standard?
We set a debt coverage standard that they have to at least to show that they're making a 1.0 to 1.05 debt coverage, which is relatively low, but it's still a reasonable debt coverage to make the property solvent.
What's the just so I'm clear here though, if the state were to liquidate, or if loans were to become insolvent, would the state have collateral to back up the loans that it's made?
The short answer is yes. Mr. Krager can say.
And again, I probably need to move on here, but I would really appreciate having someone come visit me, just to talk about how that collateral is valued. I assume it's on a market appraisal, and I assume there's some type of ratio to leave a little fudge room in there to protect the state.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, we'd be more than happy to sit down and talk to you a lot more in terms of that. I mean, that's an excellent question in terms of the protections that need to be put in place for these particular properties. I mean, again, when we issue debt, and I guess to kind of reference a little bit of Senator Verger's question yesterday in terms of when you issue bonds, there is a portion of debt reserve that you are required to set through those issuance of bonds. But beyond that, that's sort of those have bonds behind them. So it's like that's a short-term fix.
Right.
You have to actually build your indenture to be able to deal when a situation happens like we had recently where you might have to restructure that loan to help that property to the point of getting back up on its feet. So it's very critical. We're like a bank. We need to definitely have those protections.
Thank you.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman. I think moving on down to priorities number 11, and I guess I'd like to reference priorities 11, 12, 13, 14, and 16. I like to call those the big five. These are our grants and tax incentive programs, and they, again, similar to the homeless as I described together, they work collectively together. We do, as I think Mr. Gillespie referenced yesterday, a consolidated funding cycle where we get in applications, specifically to multifamily housing projects that are scored on different types of criterion. But these are the dollars that really get us to those 50%, those 40%, those 30% of area median income. And typically with the bonds, we usually hit a lot of the 60%, 50% areas just because of the underwriting. But these grants and tax incentives get us down to that very low income level.
Senator Johnson.
Within this whole block of green in here where you're talking about housing development grant programs,
mm-hmm.
This may be a question for another time, including if you just want to come to my office and explain it to me. How do you make the decision between stretching the available dollars, you have a finite amount of money, and building X number of units, versus accommodating developers who might want to do green development or put in amenities like high-speed internet? Or in what venue is the decision made in a constrained, you don't have all the money you want, to maximize the units or to have units that have particular accommodation to developers who are doing particular kinds of buildings like green buildings? Who makes those decisions?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, we can bring this copy of this to you. We have a document that is what would be the parameters of what the funding cycle applications would be made up of. And within that document, it lists elements of what we're looking for, and much of that could have green building applications. And if you are doing green building applications, you'll actually get some more scoring points because you are acknowledging the fact that you know that this is going to be a better, healthier environment for the people who are going to live there. Technology is actually one that we've put into place here recently to encourage people so we don't disadvantage or disenfranchise people who are low or moderate income people from having the ability to possibly have technology in their units, somewhat akin to when cable television came on board. When we had antennas versus cable wiring, and you know, now it's just kind of a common thing to have cable wiring for a television, and I believe, quite frankly, that technology wiring should be as commonplace as television wiring in today's living environments. So we have a criteria that everybody's aware of, and they'll compete on that same basis. And if they cannot do it for some reason, there are ways that they can either justify or choose to explain why they're not doing certain things. So it's a very...
Like to maximize more units.
Right. They can show us where the trade-offs are. But in today's environment, at the cost of units, some of those small amenities, those things that you particularly described, have such a small amount of cost impact on just the core unit that you have to build today. Probably doesn't move the price point, but a couple thousand dollars one way or the other, quite frankly.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just to touch again, as I said, on the Big Five in terms of the funding, moving to line 11, the HDGA, which is our Housing Development Guarantee Account, sometimes people call it the trust fund. These specific dollars, or we mentioned yesterday, the public purpose charge, the Housing Development Guarantee Account gets a portion of the public purpose charge, and that's what we utilize for that particular grant. In the past, you may remember, for those of you who've been on the committee for some time, that this was a general funded program at one point, and a lot, you know, over obviously with budget cuts and a alternative revenue source, these dollars have essentially come in to replace that that money that was lost over the last couple bienniums. The Home Investment Partnership Program, line item number 12, you'll notice that's a $10.4 million federal program. Again, a very big resource in terms of our grant that goes into to helping us with those low-income housing developments. The next two programs, items number 13 and 14, they're tax credit programs. You don't see the actual tax credit pieces in this. This is just essentially the dollars or the housing finance fund that we utilize to run those particular programs. So both different tax credit programs that are sold to provide dollar subsidies for the housing developments to allow those to be done. And then finally, the HELP program, jumping to line items number 16, the 1.2. This is for the very, very low income income people, that specific 30% and below. And these are dollars that we've actually achieved through some bond refundings that we had done in the past, an agreement that we had struck with the Housing and Urban Development to allow us to utilize some of those funds for a specific program. Traditionally, those are dollars that would have gone back to HUD, but they were willing to say, hey, if you do this refunding, we'll split the dollars with you, and you can serve this very low-income population. So again, those five particular areas work together in the consolidated funding cycle to provide the development. And I guess just referencing the performance measurements that I passed out earlier and that we referenced yesterday, we have some specifically in terms of our targeting of that low-income population, the 30%, the 40%, and 50% that you'll see in on performance measurements number 5 and 6, I believe, in your packet. So
once again, that's percent of SSI, federal poverty level. What is the percentage of?
That's the percentage of the area median income.
Okay, area median income. Thank you.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman,
you were going to provide that for us.
We can. And that, oh, just so you know, that varies by county by county. It's a rate set by HUD, and it will vary annually. It's readjusted annually by HUD. And it varies by county, so it won't necessarily be the same here as it might be in one of the other county areas. But we'll get that to you, too.
Okay, thank you.
We have one copy, Mr. Chairman, if you'd like to have that.
Okay.
But we get you more if you'd like.
We can take care of getting this copy. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I'll move on, and just to come back and catch line item number 15 after I jumped around there on the big five, elderly and disabled loan program. Again, this is the second of the loan programs. I started with the multifamily. This is specifically elderly and disabled. This has secured the general obligation of the state. This particular program has traditionally funded assisted living facilities, residential care facilities. It has a program that has, and you could see by our performance measurement that's related to special needs housing, has slowed down a little bit over the last several years with some of the changes with assisted living facilities. The production that the department has traditionally put out hasn't been there as much. So, but it is a program that, as you can see, again, non-limited other funds, $84 million. As with the multifamily, these are projected loan payments, projected debt service that we have for our outstanding bonds. And then, of course, the revenue source for that would be loan repayments as well as bond proceeds. And again, the $1.3 million is specifically housing finance fund resources that that we have in place to be able to pay for that particular program. The last item, and that's in the green, item number 17, is a relatively new program to the organization, Farmworker Housing Development Tax Credit. Again, operates very similar to our other two tax credit, but this is specific to farmworker housing development. I'm going to kind of peek over here to Bob. I think we have run one cycle that we have run for the farmworker housing tax credits.
I think we were actually on either our first or second. This time. We just completed our second one for reviews right now. So we've had one cycle completed, and we have applications in for this next round right now.
So, again, this is a program that was actually part of BOLI, I believe, last, and was transferred to the agency. So we are just now getting that up and running. Mr. Chairman, moving on down, we're kind of moving into the next area, items 18, and that's with the red again, our program outreach and accountability for home ownership. And this is going to cover 18 and 19, and moving on to the second page through 22. But real quickly, I'm going to talk about the last of our bond programs, which I like to call the bread and butter. This is the residential loan program. And Bob talked a little bit about our criteria early on, and one of those criteria is revenue leveraging and revenue generation. This program is ultimately, I should say, it's a key program to developing the resources that we use as a department to be able to do the things we do. This is a self-sustaining organization for the most part, and the biggest portion of revenues that we are able to get from our indentures comes from this residential loan program. So the program itself is is obviously, you know, we're doing up to $200 million, or they're projecting up to $200 million worth of first-time home loans next year. We've had a very good track record with this particular program. Again, it's thank you. It's using revenue bonds to generate dollars, as I mentioned already, for first-time home buyers. In terms of, from a revenue standpoint, again, non-limited other funds, as you can see, much bigger than the other two programs, $2 billion. This is, again, the big program within the organization. We have a huge loan portfolio. Over the last several years, we have sustained a great deal of prepayments, as you can imagine, with interest rates being low, some of the higher rate interest loans that we've had in our portfolio have begun to pay off. That has been, quite honestly, a negative to our balance sheet. And this has been a tough couple years in terms of housing in general. And when you have those high prepayments and perhaps a little bit slower origination, it's made it difficult on our balance sheet. And obviously that is always a concern for this organization when it comes to bond ratings and being able to maintain those, because Moody's looks very closely at that. So, again, I hate to spend too much time on that, but I just really want to point out that the residential loan program is a critical part of what we do.
Mr. Chairman, before we move on to the next one, I just like to add into this. One of the things we don't mention a lot in our reporting, and we there's probably a better way to do this, for it to share this information, but these type of business activities, particularly the single family loan and our multifamily program, as Rick has mentioned, is our kind of the bread and butter. This is where we become really an entrepreneur type business. This pays for much of the staffing that actually, if not being paid for the staffing within some of these other programs, would not exist, because our process has been to move as much of the either federal monies or general fund monies to our partners, because that's where that money should be spent. And so on with that in mind, to keep up with the staffing needs or the demands that are placed on us, we have basically internally generated those dollars to fill most of our staffing positions through that business activity. So just so you have a sense of our role relative to the general fund, our role is to be productive, and we see being productive meaning for us to be paying our own way as much as possible, and which in turn means more money gets out to the community partners. And so through that business activity, we're a quasi-business, which is pretty unlike most state agencies, quite frankly. They're not in a position that they can actually create and generate revenues to augment their operation costs.
Let me ask a few questions on that, if I may. When these... Are there loan closing fees, mm-hmm. and where do those revenues go to?
Mr. Chairman, they go to the cost that would be incurred, and anything over and above that is moved over to operational costs. Then the money filters through, could move to any one of the 154 people that we have working in the agency.
Who's ultimately responsible? Who in your department could I call just to find out the person who's running the program?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, in terms of running the single-family program, the person in our office that's the program manager would be John Gale. I'm sure, would love to be able to sit down and talk to you about all the great things that with single-family. But if you're looking specific to talk about financial in terms of how the program works, interested in how the bonding part, myself and my debt manager would be happy to sit down with you.
So, again, Mr. Chairman, if you notice also the amount of volume that we do, this last year we did near $200 million in sales, which is about 1,300 loans.
$200
million in bond business, of which it represents about 1,300 loans that were closed. That's accomplished by basically four people. And this is where we have that partnership with the outside lenders to help us and realtors to market and promote our project. We basically do the final certification of the loan, then buy the loan, and then transact the business that way. So we're a very small operation, but running a huge amount of volume through a business with very few people.
And is there an aging of your portfolio?
Mr. Chairman, in their single family, I think a lot has changed in the last few years due to the fact that earlier interest rates, when they were 7 or 8 or 9%, many of those people who had rates that were taken out 10 years ago, let's say, have went over to a local lender, which is good, and it refinanced it, and it moved from our book of business to somebody else's book of business. But we've seen probably a large reduction in some of our older loans, because I don't know too many people who are willing to sit around on high interest loans that where they could have refinanced them in the last few years.
Okay, what about delinquency rates?
We're about a little under 4%, which is actually very good by federal and national standards. We find, interestingly enough, that people who are buying that first-time house are very committed to doing what they need to do to try to maintain it and whatever it takes. So they try not to get into default or lose them for foolish reasons.
What's the lending rate? Is it a 5% down or a 0 down? How does that work?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, right now the loan rate's 4.95% at a 30-year fixed mortgage.
What's required for a down payment?
It depends. If you put 20%, you don't have to have mortgage insurance. So it's anything to that degree up to 20%.
But is there a zero down?
We have a program with rural development that actually is a zero down payment program.
So how does the state protect its interest with the zero down program if for some reason there
we're
was a
insured down with FHA insured or all of our loans
to cover the market value? That's good.
Thank you. The other part of that deal, just so you know, is we have also instituted, Mr. Gillespie talked about this a little bit, we've created a new program that goes along with our 4.95% program. It's called the Cash Advantage Program, which costs us another 50 basis points, but you can borrow up to 103%, so you can actually help borrow your money. No, we just don't summarily let this go to anybody. You have to show that you have good, high-quality credit ratings. It's just not for the lack of the money as opposed to the inability to pay it back.
So does that 3% go to help for the closing costs?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Along with other incentive programs that we have, the first-time homebuyer programs that was mentioned yesterday with the $1,500 with a match from lending institutes, and now the federal program called the American Down Payment Dream Program, which is another program that can allow eligible borrowers to borrow up to $10,000 as a grant to be a homeowner. That's under the Bush administration.
How difficult would it be for this committee to get a breakdown of where credits have been made in their districts?
I thought maybe you were going to ask me if you guys get a loan, and I was going to probably
pay it. It's like you could end up with positive cash flow.
Right. Make a loan we can give you a list of that. So just so you know, we have made loans of our first-time home program every county, less one, and it's in Grant. It's because there's only two houses there, and they
don't let Butler hear that.
But we have, and we can give you both the loan history over the time and when those loans, where those loans have been placed.
I think it'd be good for this committee to at least get a breakdown for their district, so they can see what activity's going on in their districts. Senator Berger.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I just wonder how many of the programs that you're going to be going through today. Our new programs, how many were in effect 10 years ago, 15 years ago? I'm rather struck by, and perhaps I'm mistaken, but just looking at this, I'm rather struck by the growth of your department. And I'm just wondering at what years have you experienced the number of growth, and are most of these programs old programs that you've had for a long time?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Berger, I would characterize, and I mean, I can give you more of a succinct history on each of the programs, but in general, most of these programs have been long-standing programs within the agency, far in excess of my tenure with the agency. We've added a couple probably since then, or modifications of some, but generally these programs have been in place. Give you an example, we were making assisted living facility loans back in the 80s, or early 80s. So most of our loan portfolio for a multifamily is just coming up on 20 to 25 years, so we've been doing loans for the greater part of that period of time. So I think most of these have been well long-seasoned programs. The federal programs and some of the limits have changed, and obviously as when you take on loans, your programs get bigger, you have more of a portfolio, you have more reasons to have more property asset management people to go out in the field, because one year you had 200 loans, and 5 years later you have 1,500 loans. So you've got to grow proportionally with that to make sure you're managing and being responsible for the requirements of credibility for the bond sales and our partners.
Please.
So the programs themselves have been in effect, but it's just been the growth within the programs.
I would say that would account for most of it. I think, as Mr. Krager whispered in my ear, probably the newest one that we've really gotten into in a larger way is the weatherization programs. That has come about because of some of the Senate Bill 1149 deregulation bills. That's also come about because of some of the litigations on overcharging in other states that we've been recipients of money. That has come to us because of a great increase of federal dollars for weatherization programs to help people of low and moderate income. So that one probably has become more of a higher, newer project program in the last 10 years than most of the projects, the total sum of weatherization.
Last question, Mr. Sure. Chairman. Number of staff that you've had to carry on the programs has increased some?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berger, I would say yes, they have. And again, as I mentioned earlier, as this staff has grown, it has come from our resources as we've developed, used the money that we make from our loan programs to staff these positions. So we're somewhat self-sustaining in that program.
Yes, I understand that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Please continue.
Mr. Chairman, moving on, second page, we're still into home ownership in the red. No pun intended. Mr. Chairman, I will try to move along as quickly as I can. Finish up on the home ownership. I want to point out real quickly, line item number 21, the home ownership assistance program. You notice that is a general funded program. I want to make the same reference. This is another part of the Oregon Housing Fund, as I had mentioned earlier with the EHA. So you will note that there's $544,000 that is offset in the other funds. So, again, this is more like a $836,000 program when you put all the resources into it, of which $544,000 comes from the general fund. So, again, to Representative Richardson's point earlier, the right number is 836, but from an accounting standpoint, we have 1.3. This particular program has it has served in terms of homeownership education. I guess I just wanted to, you asked the question earlier, Mr. Chairman, about our delinquency rate. I like to give a lot of credit to that particular program because homeownership education is a critical component to what makes success. And one of our performance measurements is that 20% of our loans that we do be with individuals that had been through the ABCs of home buying, which is our homeownership education program. So this particular resource is critical. We feel like a lot of our delinquency, our success in our delinquency rate has been to the credit of that program as well as others. I want to mention also line item number 20. It is our housing rehabilitation program. These are grants that we do specifically for rehabilitation using our community development block grant dollars. That's the $4.1 million that go in. And then lastly, item number 22. Bob alluded to this earlier. This is a newer area. It's a newer area. It's a part of the home money that we get. That initiative was put onto it, and it's specifically to down payment assistance. So this complements the program that Bob mentioned earlier in terms of our bond, our down payment assistance. Moving on, Mr. Chair, to items number 23 through 29, which we get into the purple. This is our food assistance program, and this does have a general fund component to it, the $795,000. This is money that goes to Oregon Food Bank, and I would say that this particular program area is relatively small, but it is a critical part. Everything that we send out to through the Oregon Food Bank, as well as our community action organizations and the tribes that support this, that they're able to take these dollars, and these are key leveraging dollars to be able to increase the capacity within the food banks in Oregon, the regional food. Thank you. the specific projects or programs, I should say, that support that.
Can you provide the committee with a little bit of background information on how the state of Oregon initially made the decision to fund the food banks? Is there anybody with historical knowledge on that?
We can...
Back over 10 years. Mr. Chairman, we will be glad to get that information for you.
I guess just for clarification, the food bank is a private, nonprofit corporation, organization.
Correct.
Okay, and so the state, this is a direct line item to the food bank.
Which in turn, Mr. Chairman, committee members, is then has the affiliates of other food banks and pantries statewide that they in partnership with. Okay. With these resources.
Okay, I just wanted to be very clear. Thank you.
Yes, question.
Oh, please, Representative Richardson.
It's my understanding that there is no means-based testing with food at the food bank program that anybody who comes can have meals. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, that is correct. That is a federal requirement. That is a USDA requirement. That there be no testing.
May I follow up, please? The reason I bring it up is that I've had contact with one past rector of a food bank program who felt that there was a tremendous increase in utilization by people that really did not or would not normally be thought to need this kind of assistance, but because of our connection with the federal food that would be coming, that this really was no longer about focusing on serving the poor, but just on free food. And, you know, if we've got $800,000 of general funds that are being considered here for reallocation, and you know, we'd like to have some clarification on the appropriateness of using the tax dollars in that way as compared to other programs where they're more focused on those that need it the most.
Brother, I'm conservative, but you're reaching here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, I think it's important to note, and I think probably some of the history of the general fund dollars is that many of the regional food banks are a part of community action in your local communities, and that is the connection there. These dollars are used in many ways for capacity of the network to allow the network to be able to deliver those funds, and it would be difficult to say what the income level of the people accessing those services are because we are not allowed to ask, nor are our partners allowed to question that.
Just one follow-up.
Sure.
I don't care if I'm the only one asking the questions. I'm sitting here to ask questions. So, have we always been connected with the federal requirements on this? Again, that goes back to kind of the history, but I don't know if, you know, where that, is there federal funds here that more than $5,678 that don't show up?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Richardson, I would say that you probably would find that we can get this information from the actual Oregon Food Bank. My suspicion is that they have some federal programs that will, this money helps leverage them to get federal dollars to come into the food banks through some USDA commodities programs. Or they use it to leverage other contributions, donations, resources to create, you know, millions of dollars that they acquire in food in the years in the state of Oregon. I think I think you'd find it interesting to find out the volume and amount of food that and the dollars that are spent and collected on behalf of the Oregon food banks, of what you're in a food drive right now in the capital.
Okay. What we may need to do is create a committee of two, and you and Representative Nelson can go have this discussion. Please continue on, sir. Senator Johnson.
No, I'm going to pass.
Okay, Mr. Krieger is getting back up here to now talk to you about points 30, and I'm trying to move him along. He doesn't listen very well, but he'll make every effort to get done here in the next 5 minutes.
Mr. Chairman, I will do my very, very best. I wanted to point out one thing that if you refer to page 18 of the book that we had, presentation book, it does talk about the total pounds of foods leveraged through the funds that we have provided. So if that's of any help to you, I would be, you know, to offer that.
I can just say that, you know, I serve meals whenever I can at St. Vincent de Paul in Medford, and there's many nonprofits that are out, you know, that are doing this, the gospel missions, and the whole number that provide food that, and then we have the food banks, and so I'm just trying to get a sense of how this all fits together and what the requirements are and where they are.
Mr. Chairman, if I was going to ask Representative Anderson, Richardson, your experience with the food bank at St. Vincent, is that what St. Vincent?
St. Vincent de Paul.
Oh, right. Just curious, do they income test for that, for the recipients?
No.
And I apologize for making light of that, and Representative Richardson, I publicly apologize. I was just teasing.
You don't vote for me anyway.
Please continue.
Mr. Chairman, moving on, items 30 through 33, we're moving into the energy weatherization phase. As Bob and I both alluded to, this has been one of the growth in terms of Oregon Housing Community. This has been one of the largest areas that we've seen as it relates to specific dollars. We first have on items number 31, the low-income weatherization program, a combination of other funds and federal funds that come to the department on that. Specifically, we have, this is the public purpose charge, again, that we get that is related to what we call the ECLO program. But that is the majority of the other funds portion for low-income weatherization. We also get some money from the Department of Health and Human Services, as well as the Department of Energy, through federal grants, which equates to the $6.3 million. Again, from an effectiveness standpoint, we talked a lot yesterday about the performance measurement. It is specific to the largest program, ECHO, but it does demonstrate that for every dollar spent, that we're able to demonstrate $1.18, at least from our last results. I would just like to offer that. Moving up to 32, this is a low-income energy assistance program. This is obviously a huge need that is administered through our community action organization, nearly a $50 million program. These are energy subsidies that are provided for low-income Oregonians that's administered. And then also to complement that is the Oregon Energy Assistance. This is the, as mentioned before, the Senate Bill 1149 established $20 million a biennium to go for the purposes of low-income energy assistance. Moving on down into the next area of rental assistance. As I mentioned earlier, the Section 8 had been moved up because of the low-income nature of the people. These are the remaining rental assistance program. We have what's called the Home TB, or Home Tenant-Based Assistance Program. This is a portion of the home partnership money that I had mentioned earlier that is taken off to provide rental assistance, again, administered through our community action organization. $5.8 million of federal funds that's administered through that, as well as a relatively small portion also used for rental assistance. This is our low-income rental housing fund. The dollars for this is that we get a percentage of eviction fees through the Department of from the Judicial Department related to this, and this goes into the fund and is used for rental assistance. As you can see, it's a relatively small portion, but obviously it works in conjunction with the Home TBA to provide rental assistance to low-income Oregonians. Moving next, Mr. Chairman, into items 37 through 40, we're moving into community capacity building programs. Three that to mention real quickly, regional housing coordination. Bob Gillespie talked a lot about that. We use our community development block grant monies to establish regional housing centers across the state, as he'd mentioned to you yesterday. This is a work in progress that we continue to provide sort of that one-stop shop for housing housing and services for the communities. So this is in the early stages, but we felt very there's been a lot of great deal of success to that to this point. And then a portion of our home dollars is used for our community development corporation. As the chair will remember during the last session, this was a portion that was partially funded with general fund. Mm-hmm. And this is the federal component of that, so that we continue running that particular program. Community development corporations are a key partner that we work with in housing and services areas. And then lastly, the Manufactured Dwelling Parks Community Relations Program. Gene Arana talked a lot about this. This is dollars that we get off of the personal property taxes for mobile homes and parks that's given to us for dispute resolution. And as you recall, that this was the name was changed from the
manufactured ombudsman from the last session. So those are kind of the balance of our community capacity building programs.
Really quick on that. You may have said this and I missed it. Do you block grant that out to the community development corporations?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we do have grants that go out to a variety of different community development corporations.
How do you determine the size of those grants? How do you equitably determine the size of those?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Gillespie will probably come in and help define that a little bit, but generally we look at the amount of money we have and try to set a reasonable level. I think we generally advertise that, you know, no grant will exceed an amount of money. Without, you know, not lesser circumstances would suggest otherwise, so we have kind of a baseline threshold, so people will go for a typical grant that would get dispersed more equitably around the state of Oregon.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bob Goldberg. Oh, that's the one I talked about yesterday, where we do it in partnership with the Neighborhood Partnership Fund and the Enterprise Foundation. So we're actually taking our funds and leveraging it with the other. They're $300,000, and they do look at putting funds in that enhance the capacity of the organizations, and they look at the ability of that organization to be successful over the period of that they're funding. So there are criteria that are utilized to make sure that the money is going to somebody they can utilize well.
And Mr. Chairman and committee members, we serve on the group that does the review and the scoring and makes the recommendations. So it's not. We don't just summarily surrender that activity off to somebody else. We make sure our input of information about those organizations that we have familiarity with is added to the discussion to make sure that when the final decision is made, it's been made with as much information possible.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In looking at the data here, a couple of questions. You have 5.5 FTE, but you have four positions. Could you clarify that?
That sounds like an accounting question. I think I'll defer that to my financial officer.
Monica, going to help me with this one? Mr. Chairman, Senator Morris, this is. How do I answer this? When you allocate FTE, the idea is that there are, you don't have to look specifically to this, this is the FTE is really the representation of the effort that is put in. If you have a position that maybe is serving on maybe a little bit over here and a little bit over here, you can't split the position when you get into the technical elements. So it'd be nice if I could say it was a 0.25 position and a 0.25 FTE, but the system, the way it all kind of balances out, it doesn't work that way. And that's just, I guess, more of a to answer your question, a technical portion of it. So really, for me, it's the effort is the FTE. That's the focus that we need to have.
Please follow up.
Thank you. Then the amount that's of total funds of $995,000, that was just mostly for salary? Is that what that's for?
Go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Morris, generally that money is used to contract with dispute resolution people within the community to deal with. A great portion of the money is used to that, and then the balance of that money does go towards salaries. That is, as Mr. Krager talked about, that's a 6% fee, annual fee that's charged to people who are residents or live in a $6 a year fee for people who live in manufactured housing parks or the equivalent thereof defined by statute, and so that money then is collected through the county assessor's office, sent to us. It pays for the way the statute reads, it pays for the operation of our staffing, and then and proceeds that go out to make sure mediation and people who work with the community partners can be compensated for that cost.
Hello, Mr. Chairman.
Please follow up.
I've been noticing, you know, as these budgets follow along, that it seems like, you know, for services, it's not unusual to have $180,000 per biennium for a position.
Mm-hmm.
If you multiply that times 5.5 FTE, it comes out to $990,000. And the total funds are $995,000. My question is, how many contracted
dollars are available.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morris, I can actually give you on our, probably it's in one of your books that you have, for the personal of that total, the $995,170, $679,661 is for personal services. That would be salaries. The remaining $315,509 is for service contracts, services and contracts.
Senator Johnson.
And how many disputes were paid for?
Oh, gosh.
Jeannie?
And while she's looking, I guess what it is that we're sort of all collectively struggling with is in looking at budgets and trying to decide what line of business should we be in.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere along the line, somebody thought that dispute resolution in manufactured dwelling parks was a big deal, a big enough deal to assess a $6 a head fee to pay for it. But as we're struggling to figure out, is this an appropriate line of business for a state agency to be in? And at a cost of $670,000 in salaries and $315,000 in services for a total universe served of, and I'm looking to Ms. Arana to give us that number.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, in terms of that particular number you're looking for, if you refer to page 21 of your book, it does talk about the number of individuals that we are serving from that particular
just
program.
Tell me,
for I'm sorry, 10,500 approximately.
So you did 10,000 dispute resolutions for $350,000. Ms. Arana is shaking her head. And I'm afraid, Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'd like to stay with this one until we get an answer.
You bet.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, those are the number of individuals that have been either contacted the program or have been a part of a park meeting where the mediators attended. The $6 per space per year buys not only mediation, but we also use as approximately 250,000 of that goes out into community dispute resolution centers to help fund mediations. We also have two field reps.
Other than mobile home mediations?
No.
Okay.
No. Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, the mediations, by statute, those funds must only be used to help landlord-tenant relations in manufactured dwelling parks. In addition, we provide information and referral to the general public on manufactured park living. We also produce a manufactured dwelling park directory that lists every single park and by space, by ownership in the state. So there are a number of activities that are going on within that program.
And I don't mean to pick on this one. I'm just trying to make a point. What would happen if we gave the $6 back and the directory didn't get published? How big a burden would this be on somebody somewhere? Would landlords have to take the responsibility for working out their own mediations? Are we protecting particularly vulnerable populations and they're really buying a service for their $6? And what I'm struggling with is $670,000 in salaries, and one would expect that those will just continue to roll up. $315,000 in purchased services, and I'm just trying to get a sense for if this all went away, mm-hmm. how serious is the outcome?
Mr. Chairman, maybe I'll try to field that one for Senator Johnson. I feel like the historian, so let me take you back when this all started back once upon a time. It actually started what was then the Manufacturing Housing Ombudsman Program was put into law in 1991. Because of a very strong sense of disenfranchising by residents who live in manufactured housing parks, the landlord-tenant laws that are written for the state of Oregon do not apply to park tenants. And so they felt very vulnerable. And if you can envision this as the typical story would be told to you by somebody, particularly an elderly person who has invested all their equity into this unit, and with certain conditions when they moved in there, and as time goes on and certain transactions of the sale of the park changes, certain conditions start changing. and rents go up, and the trash that they were getting for free, now they got to pay another $20 for it. So the story goes on that way. The reason that this was actually brought to the Legislative Assembly by the organization called OSTA, which is the Manufactured Housing Tenants Association, because they felt they needed some forum to be able to have some fed state entity or government work with them to help defend and identify the improprieties that have been and continually have been going on over the years in parks. So it was a self-imposed, not by the direction of the assembly, but actually we're willing to pay them $3. That went on until I think about 1993 or 1995. Then they came back and said, we actually want to charge $6 because we want some more things with that money. And along with those things we want with that $6, it is this more global process to be able to have mediation closer in our communities, to have publications that need to be, that we believe are valuable or important to identifying commonalities with these 68,000 people who live in manufactured housing parks around the state of Oregon, so we can gain force together because they have us so outnumbered as we're individuals. And so that's the history of how it came about.
And
to your question, if it all blew up and went away, it probably would not. I mean, it's a program we have. If the money stopped, then it wouldn't be a program we have. I think you would find over time, or you would find that even in today's environment, from tenants who live in manufactured housing parks, there is a sense of survival in many cases, and this is really one of their only outlets to be able to have a voice, to have somebody who helps represent them to get some quality.
I don't disagree. First, I appreciate the history lesson. Secondly, I don't disagree with anything that you have said. Up until I'm trying to get some quantitative, and I just happened to pick this one as a line item. It could apply to almost any one of the lines and almost any one of the budgets. We've gotten in the last couple of sessions and five special sessions most of the low-hanging fruit. And as we're looking around in another austere budget cycle, what lines of business should government be in or not be in? And I'm just trying to bring this back to a results-driven process that says, sure, it's a good program, but how many people were served and what costs were saved, and why is it that if this is a great program, I still read in the Oregonian about a trailer park out by Lake Oswego that's about to get wiped out anyway, $6 notwithstanding, and all of those old people displaced. And where a single wide home that can't be moved may be their single largest asset. I'm just trying to say volume versus results, and how in any of these budgets do we get a handle on how many people were actually served, and is the $6 an efficacious, prudent purchase, or would it make more sense to give the $6 back and stop doing this?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, I think that's a fair question to ask. And as we are the stewards of the statute and do this because it was set up that way, I think probably the best question would be asking organizations such as OSTA or Tenant Park Associations to find out if they still value the $6 that each one of them chips into this on an annual basis. If, in fact, they would rather have the $6, I would say probably you could eliminate it.
One more comment.
Of course.
And Mr. Repine, that's fair. You've been a legislator, and so you have the benefit of both making the policy decision and now administering the agency. I'm not sure that it's, for somebody as sophisticated as you are, that I should let you off the hook by saying we're just the stewards of the decisions made by the legislature. I think some of us are looking to the agencies to say, what makes sense? When was the last time you turned your portfolio upside down and said, this is something that is a good buy for Oregonians versus we've been doing it since 1991 and it seems like somebody values the program and so we just keep on doing the program? It's a more global question than it is this line item and the $6.
And I think that's a fair question, Senator Johnson. Just to try to put it in a framework for us, we meet with the tenant associations and park members on an ongoing basis. We discuss the aspects of what they want us to accomplish and how they want us to accomplish it. If they as a group said, it's been 10 years and plus in running and I don't know whether or not we don't have the same emphasis or the same what we thought we were getting when we first instituted this. We only run the program not to discourage them, but to try to give them the service that they expect from us on an annual basis. So we've always kept the dialogue open with them. We always work with them on a regular basis. And I haven't heard any of them that necessarily said, let's just terminate. And I don't, quite frankly, I don't know whether or not we can always make those type of analysis on programs. But you, as you know, and I know, for every program that's here, there's somebody who has a tremendous amount of reason to keep it there.
I know that, and I just want to say, for the benefit of anybody who's been listening to this, don't send 80 people to my office to convince me why the mobile home ombudsman person stands between us and the end of life as we know it. I'm trying to engage you as an agency chair in a more philosophical, global conversation of 3 pages of stuff. And if we have to come in here and say this isn't core to your mission anymore in the judgment of the legislature, how do you as an agency head and your brother and sister agency heads throughout state government help us in an austere budget come to that conclusion? That's the point of this.
And I think that's the next phase of our discussion when we get to talking about those, kind of delineating the priorities and what we have put on the table for consideration, because those are those decisions we've made based on particularly general fund items. Again, this not being a general funded item, it probably didn't tickle our fancy, because we were saying that's money that's been pledged by an organization who has effectively an ongoing basis that we'll let you know when we don't want this program to exist anymore. And so until we've been put on notice, we assume that we've been doing a reasonable job for them.
For those citizens listening, that's Senator Betsy Johnson, Oregon State Capitol, Salem, Oregon. If I knew your office number.
I think Representative Richardson and I might be visiting with you outside this hearing later.
I have too much free time. We do have Representative Avakian and Representative.
And for the record, that was Chair Smith that said he had too much free time, and calls may be directed there as well. As somebody who has spent at least several different times in mediations that your program has provided to residents that are in my district, I have intimate knowledge of how this works. And what if we touch on this topic again, what would be of interest to me is not the number of people that are served, but the result of the service that's provided. Mediation is usually most effective when there is a hammer that can fall if the mediation doesn't successfully resolve the dispute. And please feel free to put it on the record if I'm wrong about this, but I don't believe a hammer exists in this state for landlords of these manufactured home parks if they are violating the rules and the mediation isn't successful. My guess is that the mediations, even though they provide some comfort to these vulnerable people that don't have any other avenue, which is why I think they hang on to it, I'm not convinced in any respect that the result justifies the cost. So if we touch on this again, it might be good for you to talk about the quality rather than the quantity of what's being provided.
We're going to go to Representative Richardson next, and then we're going to take about 5 more minutes to get through this final list, and then we're going to get to the 10% reduction.
I'm sure Mr. Krager heard you say that.
Perfect.
Senator Berger, you'll remember an email I sent you 2 years ago, almost to the day, it's in light of what you were saying, Senator Johnson, when I asked the question, said, those that are considering budget, seems to me that they should ask a fundamental question on each of the programs, and that is, if it didn't exist today, would we create it? Mm-hmm. And you'd commented to me at that time. You said, that's a reasonable thing to be considering. And I would think that we might, again, consider that as one of the criteria as we look at prioritizing. Just ask that question, because if the answer is, well, no, then those funds may be able to be used elsewhere. Anyway, just would add that to our criteria.
Mr. Chairman, before we cut Mr. Krager loose again, I'd like to, if I could, respond to Representative Vaughan's statement. I think probably, quantity versus quality is a good question to ask. I think the other underlying piece is, and there's no way to quantify this, is that, and you say, as you have said, you have been involved in numerous of these. If not this approach, how many people would not have either would have had to spend a tremendous amount of their resources to go to court, or would not have had resources which would have caused them to be then violated or taken advantage of because they just couldn't fight the fight? And so I think in light of all the parameters that are out there, this is really, like you said, this is the best they got.
Well, with except that very few of these people are going to take anybody to court because they're penniless.
Right.
And even though the mediation occurs, I would wonder whether or not that really resolved the issue and they're still being taken advantage of anyway because there's no consequence if the landlord doesn't follow through. And that's what I mean by the quality analysis rather than the quality, not meaning that you guys don't do a good job, just meaning there's no way to enforce anything you do.
Right. Again, it is really just the generalization of good. Hopefully, at the end of the day, everybody agrees on moving ahead on being successful.
Let's move forward here,
Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Just real quickly, and I know I got 5 minutes, so I will move rapidly. 3 minutes. Line item number 41, just real quick, OHOP, Oregon Housing Opportunities and Partnership. This is I like to say it's the one area that we have actually more of a direct relationship with the clients. We're actually working with people with AIDS or people with HIV in terms of helping them into housing, not a natural fit with the housing. We work very closely with the Department of Health and Human Services on that particular program. So it is a complete federal-funded program of $1.5 million. Item number 42, tenant readiness program. It was mentioned briefly yesterday. This is a very successful program, a guarantee program, relatively low cost, but it has huge success in terms of working with landlords and trying to formulate some kind of guarantee so that low-income people or people that had unsuccessful credit ratings could actually get into rental housing. So very successful program that we've seen over the last few years. Moving to the third page, last two capacity building programs. The Community Incentive Fund, as Mr. Gillespie mentioned yesterday, $20 million worth of bonds that were actually issued back in actually combination 2003. This particular program has been part specific to the statute in terms of helping through community development, revitalization, transportation issues, a combination of it's a little bit different than other programs that we have had. As many of you may recall, this was a program that we actually had suspended last biennium to utilize some of the resources to backfill the reduction of our Oregon Housing Trust Fund that was used for general fund shortfalls. So a portion of $5.5 million of these funds continue to sit there. However, there's still activity that's ongoing. These projects, we're continuing to fund them in terms of the completion of the project. In addition, there are some that have loans, so there's loan payments that come back that we are actually utilizing for new, smaller community incentive fund projects. So
let me interject there really quick just for the committee. I want to put on the record that I have a potential conflict of interest as my company has worked with a county who potentially has received dollars from this program and may potentially in the future. Thank you.
Just to point out the sources real quick, the $4.4 million of lottery funds, that is essentially set aside for the payment of the debt service on the bonds. The dollars are transferred through us, and we pay the Department of Administrative Services. So that is specifically for the debt service on the outstanding bonds. The 5.5 is what we project in terms of dollars that will be freed up in terms of the release from the Housing Trust Fund for the biennium, as well as some of the loan repayments coming through. Item number 44, $5.3 million Commission for Voluntary Action Service. You all heard from Kathleen Joy yesterday. This is a program that we've had for the last couple bienniums in our program. I know that she provided you some specific information on that. It is a federal fund program that does have a match requirement. They have been very creative in terms of utilizing in-kind resources as their matching. And this is a program that had general fund previous biennium, but was eliminated.
Lastly, Mr. Chairman, permission, I will go items 45 through 53. I see these particular programs are back to the affordable housing development. I see these programs as some of our smaller areas that complement like our residential loan program or Habitat for Humanity, where we're able to provide 0% monies. We have a loan guarantee program as well as pre-development. All of these are essentially from bonding resources, again, complementing the development of affordable housing, allowing that to happen, as well as homeownership programs. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I will close and move on to the reductions, unless there are other questions.
I think we have a few questions here. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The FTE position of 150.58, is that after the reductions or prior to the reductions?
Mr. Chairman, that is before the reductions that we're about ready to present.
So it's before. And then if I look at the agency reduction sheet that you have in your appendix C, you're projected a 3.25 FTE reduction.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morse, yes, that's correct. 3.25 FTE would be what was in what is in our 10% reduction plan.
Mr. Chairman, I guess just an observation, that doesn't seem like very many for a 10% reduction. That's just an observation.
Thank you. Please continue.
Mr. Chairman, moving on to our reductions, I will, if you like, start at the top, the way that this was organized, and I think you all have that particular page. Is that correct? I'm going to make sure that it was part of, I think, the pack Monica provided to you.
Mm-hmm. That is correct.
The first reduction item, and again, these are, I guess, looking at this as our highest priority, this would be what we wouldn't want to have reduced. I guess that's the way we work down. So it would be the statewide homeless assistance program. As I mentioned before, the general fund program, the general fund dollars that we have essentially fund three areas. They fund the food banks, they fund the homeless assistance programs, as well as the homeownership assistance. So there's not a lot of programs that you can choose from in terms of reducing. The largest, of course, is our homeless program. So what we have done here is a $659,000 cut to that program or proposal. The impact related to that particular program would be approximately, we estimate, 7,702 individuals served, which includes about 5,914 of emergency shelter or people in emergency shelter. You can see also the breakdown. As I mentioned before, there's a combination of different services that this provides. We see 195 in transitional housing, but obviously the biggest hit would be emergency shelters. Again, that's the first item. Moving on down, and again, this is the next item that we would our highest priority would be Section 8. Again, because of the way it's set up, there is a need to cut non-limited federal funds. That's a $10.1 million. And I guess to Senator Morse's comment in terms of the small amount of FTE, in this particular, a lot part of our budget is non-limited. And so what you're talking about when you make a cut of $10 million is federal subsidies. There is no FTE associated with federal subsidies. It's essentially, that's all it is subsidies. So when you start and look down, okay, $249 million, boy, you would expect a lot of FTE. But most of this FTE is coming from non-limited resources, and I'll point that out at the next item as well. So, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, Mr. Chairman, Senator Morris, actually, if you on the original color sheet that Mr. Krager was working on, if you go to the positions and correlate those with the general fund items, which then have subsequent reductions that are on the column 15, it says 10% reductions of general funds. Of the general fund items that we show you on the first column, or column 5, there's a total of 5 positions or 3.7 FTEs involved with those general fund items. So it actually corresponds with the number of reductions almost to the same number. Those once if those reductions are to come take place, those positions that are associated to those general fund items will be gone.
Mr. Chairman, moving on down, again, Section 8, just to touch on that, if essentially we lost $10 million of subsidy, we would be affecting about 971 households of incomes that are 30%. Again, these are the very, very lowest income. And in addition, I think it's important to note that there are contracts with these projects that essentially by... I'm not sure of the legal ramifications for some form of if we were not to accept those subsidies. I think, you know, we'd have to work through that particular issue, but I think it would be a violation of the contractual obligation that is with the landlords, and the money just essentially passes through us. Moving on down, again, number 19 in our total prioritization. Again, really the only place that you can look to is our bond programs and the non-limited. And again, you're looking at of the $249 million, $219 million that we would need to shave off of our residential loan program. Again, this is related to loans made. And it's, again, funded with tax-exempt bonds. So essentially, by not doing those loans, you're basically foregoing the tax-exempt right that you have as a state to issue bonds. So,
Senator Johnson.
I still am struggling with this whole 10% reduction process and how it is a valuable tool in helping make decisions. In our earlier conversation, we talked about how problematic the Section 8 piece was in terms of service to Oregonians. You've just talked in the remarks that you just made about the ramifications of rejecting federal funds. In the instructions that you were given as an agency in preparing your 10% cuts, describe to us what those instructions were and why that would lead you to conclude that offering up 10% out of your Section 8 made any sense in a decision-making process.
Why don't we have Monica take a first shot at that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just some introductory remarks to that before the agency responds to how they got to that particular one. Remember, agencies had to do a 10% by each funding source. So in the non-limited bonding piece, they couldn't take 12% of a different program and only 8% in that particular funding source. They have to do 10% in general funds, 10% in lotteries. So that's the first piece. Then they were given some instructions and quite a bit of latitude about how to prioritize within each of those. But when you're talking the federal fund, non-limited, they only have federal subsidy in that fund type.
Okay. That's...
We're getting there.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Please continue.
Mr. Chairman, and again, the bulk of what we would have to cut in the non-limited, I guess to Monica's point, about the only place you could go is the residential loan program because it is the most substantial bond program that we have. So, and basically that would be, you know, the impact. Moving on down to the next priority, and this is again affects the general fund program. It's ranked number 21 within our total 53 priorities, is the homeownership assistance program. I should mention that this potential program started out as approximately 800,000 general funded program. There was some program reductions that we took in our governor's recommended budget, of which $250,000 come out of that. Again, this is the program that operates our ABCs of home buying. It also provides down payment assistance to low-income Oregonians. It basically, with a $250,000 cut, you're looking at pretty much complete elimination of your ABCs of home buying, your educational program, as well as a pretty substantial cut within the down payment system. It only leave you about $294,000, so the majority of that would have to be directed towards down payment assistance.
Can you folks come visit me at a later time? I want to go back to comments made by Senator Johnson, and Representative Richardson. With the many different housing programs that you folks offer, I'd like to know the impact the state of Oregon would feel if we didn't have this one, if we took that general fund and used it for other purposes. do we have programs that could step in and serve a niche? Are we double serving? And in the interest of time, I think at our next meeting, let's talk about that, and I'll make note of it as well. And if Monica would address that issue with us as well.
Mr. Chairman, we'd be more than happy to address it now, but if in the interest of time you would like to
I think in the interest of time we better keep moving. But that is something I'd like to know.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I will point out that, again, because of that funny little technical accounting thing that we talked about earlier,
right.
You notice that this is a 250 and a 255, so, again, this would have an effect to limitations in both the other funds as well as the general fund program. Next on the list, Mr. Chairman, in our efforts to try to preserve as much as we can to our number one priority, homeless assistance, and also our number three priorities in terms of overall home ownership, we did have to take a little bit from our general fund food assistance as well. You note that there's $70,000. Our estimated impact to that would be about a loss of $217,000. Again, this is a demonstrated leverage that the Oregon Food Bank can basically take $70,000 and turn it in, or three times more, into $217,000 of local and federal resources. So there would be an impact at the local level as in terms of their capacity and being able to deliver the appropriate food services to the people that need them. So there is a small reduction to that that the agency has set forth. Moving into the next priority down the list, the low-income, again, moving into the federal fund resources that we have to come up with, the low-income energy assistance, which is number 32 in terms of our total list of priorities, that's a $5.182 million reduction that we would have to take, which would affect about 18,000 households total. There would be a FTE portionate cut related to that particular program of about 0.25, but the majority of the dollars already go out to the communities. In fact, many times we as an agency have redirected our administrative dollars to actually go to the program. So the ones that really suffer in this particular case is the people that need it the most. So, again, 18,500 households total. The next piece, again, to get to our other fund area, which is our largest other fund program, Oregon Energy Assistance, $7.8 million. This would affect another 27,955 households. So you can see in total, our energy efforts, about $13 million of total resources lost for energy assistance.
This question? Representative Richardson.
Just by clarification from the line above, when you said 18,510 households would lose the energy assistance if $5.1 million was taken from a $49.8 or $50 million budget, are you saying then that there's actually 180,000 households that are receiving assistance presently?
Mr. Chairman, I think that, you know, what we see on average is about, I'm going to look back to Gene, about $260 per subsidy on the energy assistance. So basically we take that subsidy or the portion and divide by 260 to come up with the net impact. So in terms of the multiplication, I do want to reference real quickly the $50 million that you reference. A portion of that, approximately $9 million, is used for our weatherization that comes from LEAP, as we call it. So about $40 million divided by the 260 is what we serve.
So about 140,000 households are receiving this then.
Right. Just looking, Mr. Chairman, just real quickly looking in terms of our number of low-income energy assistance on page 15, you have in 2003 58,500 individuals served. In 2004 you had 54,000 individuals served, and that was on, you know, specifically our low-income energy assistance program. Also noted there's another 16,253 and 23,421 individuals served on the Oregon Energy Assistance Program. So yes, there's a great deal of individuals that are served through this particular program.
The follow-up then,
please.
You just now say 60-some thousand for the energy assistance?
For the low-income energy assistance program, yes.
If we take 10% of the fund, even if you take off the 20,000, we're going from 140,000 to, we're taking away 5 million of it, and we're going to affect 18,000. So we're going to affect almost a third by taking away only 8 to 12% or whatever the number would be?
Mr. Chairman, I can probably get my backup documentation in terms of that and work with Representative Richardson to be able to more articulate that, if that's your pleasure. I mean,
would you like that?
Sure, but I think that before we punt, I just wanted to deal with our numbers because we're going with what you tell us, and we're saying if we cut 5 million, we'll lose 18,000, but the total currently being served is 60-some thousand for energy assistance. Is that the number that you were saying?
Mr. Chairman, the total number of individuals in 2004 that was served with energy assistance,
right?
Total number within both programs was 77,000 people.
So it's 77,000
per year.
Okay, per year. Oh, okay. So we're talking about biennial money here. So that would double.
Right.
Okay. Right, gotcha. This is biennial. Thank you.
Sorry about the confusion.
Please continue.
Good question.
Where was it? Okay, I'm sorry. So we were on 32, LEAP and OEA, as I mentioned, $13 million total for those two programs. The next area, and to Senator Johnson's question earlier, this is another one of those programs that we have to take a cut in lottery funds. The only place to get it is the debt service that we pay on community incentive funds, so that's my only program that I can look to. So, again, this is primarily money to pay just for debt service. That is all. There's no FTE, nothing associated with it, so that's how we would have to come up with that. In terms of accomplishing that, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure. I mean, this is the debt service that we need to pay the outstanding bonds. I think if there was some form of restructuring or something of that form, you might be able to accumulate that type of savings. Mr. Chairman, the last area that we have from a priority standpoint is the Commission for Voluntary Action and Services. It's a $5.3 million reduction. Essentially, the impact of this, and we've talked to this committee before on this, we see opportunities in which the Commission for Voluntary Action Services might be a standalone 501c3, that there's a potential there. So that would obviously, there are staff that are associated with running that organization. You met Kathleen yesterday, as well as some of the relationships she has with Portland State University that is funded through this. But we see that there would be an opportunity to perhaps spin that off into its, you know, if you were looking to decrease the federal dollars to be able to do that.
Senator Morris earlier asked a question about the staffing, and you provided an answer. It didn't click with me. Can you once again explain to us why with $249 million worth of reductions, there's only 3.25 reduction in FTE?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would point out that of that $249 million of reduction, you're looking at essentially $230 million of it being non-limited resources, which is the form of bonds, rent subsidy, debt service, to meet that criteria. So your line items of lottery funds, other funds, lottery funds, non-limited other funds, non-limited federal funds, would make up the majority of that, would leave you with approximately $9 million.
So let me ask this question. What if this committee, in its prioritization process, decided that it wanted to take interest earnings or fee income? What would the effect be then?
Mr. Chairman, good question. I mean, in terms of, I assume what you're talking about in terms of dollars that is generated through the bond programs, through interest income, things like that, the impact would be, we would have to cut staff. Bottom line, I mean, we have, as you well know, have taken money out of the program in the past to actually fund programs. We have had our challenges in terms of trying to, and you will see when we get into phase two, one of our policy option packages to try to redirect and utilize federal resources more to pay for the necessary staff to run these programs.
And this goes back to what I believe Director Repine was talking about, that the entrepreneurialism of the programs and that interest earnings and fee income, if you will, are dollars that are used to support the staffing of these programs.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. That's the majority of what we use. And
I will say that, you know, and this is always kind of the challenge in terms of describing the Housing Finance Fund, and I think that your fine LFO staff has said something to me one time before, is that our dollars are looked like as somewhat of annuity, that we basically have been able to establish reserves that protect the department in case of default, and the way that it works in terms of taking money to pay for operations mm-hmm. is that we get a cash flow. A distribution is the limit that we can take, and we have to live within those cash flows.
It's a very standard model.
Yes, yes, sir.
It's used nationwide. It's used with the smallest loan programs all the way to these large ones. I have one last question, and then if the committee has any.
Mr. Chairman, let me follow up on what Mr. Kreger just said. I think he made more of a valid point to the discussion of what we're allowed to take with the federal programs is even if we were, and in many cases, we're successful, actually becoming more financially successful, there's a limit, and we have to give the rest of the money back to the federal government. So we have a cap in most of our loan programs that even if we were able to generate more because of good business practices, good bond sales, or a variety of things that could change it, where we could say, look, we doubled the amount of earnings. At the end of the year, the federal government says, no, you're only eligible for 1.2 or 1.4% of that money. Anything over that comes back to us. And so we even have built-in limits that, so it's not a, what you call a true entrepreneur business. It has a limit on what we're allowed to get in that entrepreneur activity.
How would you convince this committee that you're maximizing your interest earnings with the bank that you have your deposits with?
Methuselah.
Mr. Chairman, the majority of our interest income that you see in terms of our budget, I mean, obviously, a lot of that we need to get into loans. I mean, that's where we get, you know, if we go out and we issue bonds that give us overall cost of borrowing of 4%, you know, we go out and we tack on in terms of our spread and our fees, and that's where, you know, obviously we get the interest income for that. In terms of dollars, let's say we issue bonds related to acquisition accounts and the money sits, we obviously use the Oregon Short-Term Fund at the State Treasurer's Office for a portion of our dollars. A lot of the payments that come back, as was described, they come back from the servicers. They sit in the Oregon Short-Term Fund, and I will say that, you know, we've enjoyed actually a very good rate from the Oregon Short-Term Fund compared to some of the some of the money market type funds that we've seen, you know, in local banks. In terms of our trustee activity, we also have a trustee. We do have an active investment department in our office that does a very fine job in terms of maximizing our returns on the eligible investments. And that's one of the key things, is that there are only certain types of investments that we can get into as it relates to bond proceeds. I mean, we obviously can't go out and invest.
I guess my question is, how often do you shop interest rates on at the bank of Susla? I'm from Eastern Oregon. How often do you shop rates? How do you know we're not getting how do you know we're getting the best rate of interest on our money there?
Mr. Chairman, well, in terms of the monies that sit at CyUSLA, I mean, there is a weekly type transfer. So it doesn't, I mean, it basically filters right through CyUSLA and goes into our Oregon Short-Term Fund.
But do we not capture any earnings then on even that week?
Mr. Chairman, we do get a RFP, obviously, to all of our bank servicers on a every 2 to 3 year basis to make sure that we are getting the best prices and the best rates possible in terms of...
That's what I wanted to hear. Okay. Thank you. Representative Avakian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to ask you, I guess, more a conceptual question about what you've provided us and what you would be recommending, for lack of a better term. And to illustrate it, let me take the example that Senator Johnson took such delight in with the manufactured homes mediation services, which had an other fund number of about $995,000. And looking at your agency reduction page, take the example of, for instance, the $250,000 for grants for home ownership, education, and down payment. I would guess that what you're telling us is that if we're going to make a cut, you'd rather have us make it out of grants for home ownership or, for instance, down the page, energy assistance to low-income people instead of the manufactured dwelling park mediation service, since that one is not included on your reduction list. Am I interpreting that correctly?
Yes. Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Representative Joaquin, yes.
Okay.
Any other questions? I'd like to throw out one more scenario that I'd like to...
Mr. Chairman, do you mind if I just make one more comment
please.
In terms of that? Keep in mind, Mr. Chair, Representative Joaquin, when you made the comment about the $250,000 of homeownership assistance program, I'm limited in terms of the programs that I can choose. I mean, again, you need a 10% reduction out of general fund. So by cutting MDPO, manufactured dwelling park homes, that still doesn't get me to what you need in the general fund reduction. So, again, I'm limited to three programs that I can choose from in the general fund. So I just want to make sure that that was clear.
When you're doing your housing projects, how often do you work with the Economic and Community Development Department in terms of their special public works fund?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, we will run into their programs on some basis through reviewing applications to find out that a potential applicant who's coming to us for some housing resources are showing some other funding from a program such that Economic Community Development does run. But we don't have a arm-in-arm working relationship as to making sure that their efforts and our efforts were coordinated together.
If a community was going to be putting together a housing project, let's say a subdivision,
mm-hmm.
And they were taking raw land, it's quite feasible that a small rural community could make application to the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department for a special public works grant loan combination, and also make application to you folks for some form of housing in that subdivision. That's a fair scenario, isn't it?
Mr. Chairman, correct. That would be a fair scenario. Probably the one we see more commonly would be a community who goes to Economic Community Development to request CBDG money that because they're not an entitlement area, so they draw from the state pool for some infrastructure, sewer, water, or something of that nature that will be coupled into a funding source into the application. So that's how we indirectly run into them.
Right. And for this committee, that one of the things we want to explore as we're looking at efficiencies and establishing priorities is trying to determine, are there better linkages or better partnerships? And without any commentary today, the one thing I would point out is that there is a partnership or at least a budding together, if you will, of the two departments and some of the roles they play. And that ought to be something we investigate as we go through this process.
Mr. Chairman, just so you know, I was being whispered to as you were talking. Just to make sure we get it on the record straight, CBDG money has some limitations as far as it could be used for public purposes and public right-of-ways. So you would see the resources maybe to be a contribution for the continuation of a city sidewalk or the extension or upsizing of utilities in the public street already. It may not necessarily go on to the developable property, but it'll be a adjunct to the overall cost of the development.
Sure. And I think that's just important for this committee to understand that there is a linkage between those infrastructure programs and the housing programs that you provide. I think we went through a whole heck of a lot of information. Are there any final questions or comments? I think our committee looks a little worn out today. So, Director Repine, thank you very much for coming forward. Thank you.
Oh, I know.
And with that said, I think we are going to be adjourned until Monday. Thank you.